Hello, and welcome to episode 13 of Other Voices, Other Choices. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of the series. This episode is America, the Farewell Tour, a talk by Chris Hedges. He spoke at the Unitarian Church of All Souls in New York City on December 9, 2018. The audio is sourced from a YouTube video of the same name, which was filmed by Joe Friendly and can be found on his YouTube channel. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges spoke of the decay and degeneration of the American economy, culture, and government, of criminal wars such as those in Afghanistan and Iraq, and of the looming economic catastrophe. And now, Chris Hedges.
The French sociologist Emile Durkheim, in his book On Suicide, examined the disintegration of social bonds that drive individuals and societies to personal and collective acts of self-destruction. He found that when social bonds are strong, individuals achieve a healthy balance between individual initiative, self-actualization, and communal solidarity, which he called a life-sustaining equilibrium. These individuals and communities, he found, have the lowest rates of suicide. The individuals and societies most susceptible to self-destruction, he wrote, are those for whom these social bonds, this equilibrium, have been shattered. Societies are held together by a web of social bonds that give individuals a sense of being part of a collective and engaged in a project larger than the self. This collective expresses itself through meaningful work, democratic participation, worship, and values, and even patriotism and shared national beliefs. The bonds provide meaning, a sense of purpose, status, and dignity. They offer psychological protection from impending mortality and meaninglessness that comes with being isolated and rejected. The disintegration of these bonds plunges individuals into deep psychological distress that leads ultimately to acts of self-annihilation. Durkheim called this state of hopelessness and despair anomie, which he defined as rulelessness. Rulelessness means the norms that govern a society and create a sense of organic solidarity no longer function. The belief, for example, that if we work hard, obey the law, and get a good education, we can achieve stable employment, social status, and mobility, along with financial security, is no longer true. The old rules that were imperfect and often excluded poor people of color, nevertheless, were not a complete fiction in the United States. They offered some Americans, especially those from the white working and middle class, modest social and economic advancement. But the capture of political and economic power by corporate elites, along with the redirecting of all institutions toward the further consolidation of their power and wealth, has broken the social bonds that held the American society together. This rupture has unleashed a widespread malaise and self-destructiveness Durkheim would have recognized. When society is strongly integrated, he wrote, it keeps individuals in a state of dependency, holding them to be in its service and consequently not permitting them to dispose of themselves as they wish. Society is thus opposed to them escaping from their obligations towards it through death. The bond that attaches them to their common purpose attaches them to life, and in any case, the high goal towards which their gaze is turned alleviates the suffering that they feel from life's troubles. Finally, in a coherent and vital community, there is a continual exchange of ideas and feelings from all to each and from each to all, which is like mutual moral support, so that the individual, instead of being reduced to his or her resources only, participates in the collective energy and draws on it when his or hers is exhausted. Our corporate coup d'etat and our failed democracy has freed the oligarchs from all legal and moral constraints. The state of disorganization or anomie is thus reinforced by the fact that passions are less disciplined at a time when they need stronger discipline, Durkheim noted, of the avarice of the rich. It is not for nothing that so many religions have celebrated the benefits and the moral value of poverty, Durkheim wrote. This is because of all schools. It is the one that best teaches humankind to restrain itself. By obliging us to exercise constant discipline over ourselves, it prepares us to accept collective discipline with docility, while wealth, by exalting the individual, constantly risks awakening the spirit of rebellion that is the very font of immortality. Professor Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page, in their study of legislative laws, wrote, "The central point that emerges from our research is that the economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while mass-based interest groups and average citizens have little or no independent influence. In essence, the electoral process is a facade, one where we choose between the friendly and inclusive form of corporate fascism under the Democratic Party or the raw, racist, Christian fascism of Donald Trump's white man's party. The economic structures, like the political structures, have been reconfigured to keep the working class in a state of constant distress. American productivity, as the New York Times pointed out, has increased 77% since 1973, but hourly pay has grown by only 12%. If the federal minimum wage was attached to productivity, it would be more than $20 an hour, not $7.25 an hour. Some 41.7 million workers, a third of the U.S. workforce, earn less than $12 an hour, and most of them do not have access to employer-sponsored health insurance. A decade after the 2008 financial meltdown, the Times noted, the average middle-class family's net worth is more than $40,000 below what it was in 2007, and the net worth of black families has declined by 40%, and for Latino families, this figure has dropped by 46%. The financial crisis of 2008 saw the world's central banks, including the Federal Reserve, inject trillions of dollars of fabricated money into the global financial system. The Federal Reserve, which is supposed to regulate banks alone, handed over an estimated $29 trillion of fabricated money to American banks, according to researchers at the University of Missouri. $29 trillion. Kevin Sees and Margaret Flowers from Popular Resistance wrote, one-sixth of this could provide a $12,000 annual basic income, which would cost $3.8 trillion annually, doubling Social Security payments to $22,000 annually would cost $662 billion, and a $10,000 bonus for all U.S. public school teachers would cost $11 billion. Free college for all high school graduates would cost $318 billion, and universal preschool would cost $38 billion. National improved Medicare for all would actually save the nation trillions of dollars over a decade. The Fed and other central banks cut interest rates to near zero, and some central banks in Europe instituted negative interest rates, meaning they would pay borrowers to take loans. The Fed, in a clever bit of accounting, even permitted distressed banks to use these no-interest loans to buy U.S. Treasury bonds. The banks gave the bonds back to the Fed and received 0.25% interest from the Fed. In short, the banks were loaned money at virtually no interest by the Fed and then were paid interest by the Fed on the money they borrowed. The Fed also bought up worthless derivatives and other toxic assets from the banks. And since federal authorities could fabricate as much money as they wanted, it did not matter if what they were buying was worthless. This fabricated money has created a worldwide debt of $325 trillion, more than three times global GDP. The fabricated money was hoarded by banks and corporations, loaned by banks at predatory interest rates, used to service interest on often unsustainable debt, or spent buying back stock, providing billions in compensation for the ruling elites. The fabricated money was not provided to the victims of financial fraud, but the victimizers. It was not invested in the real economy. Products were not manufactured and sold. Workers were not reinstated into the middle class with sustainable incomes, benefits, and pensions. Infrastructure projects were not undertaken. The fabricated money reinflated massive financial bubbles built on debt and papered over a fatally diseased financial system destined for collapse. The criminal irresponsibility of these elites was simply perpetrated again on an even more massive scale. What will trigger the next crash? The $13.2 trillion in unsustainable U.S. household debt? The $1.5 trillion in student debt? The billions Wall Street has invested in the fracking industry that has spent $280 billion more than it generates from its profits? Who knows? What is certain is that a global financial crash, one that may dwarf the meltdown of 2008, is inevitable. And this time, with interest rates near zero, the elites have no plan B. The financial structure will disintegrate. The global economy will go into a death spiral. The rage of a betrayed and impoverished population will, I fear, further empower right-wing demagogues who promise vengeance on the global elites, moral renewal, and a nativist revival, heralding a return to a mythical time when immigrants, women, and people of color knew their place, and in the United States, a Christianized fascism. Given the staggering amount of fabricated money that has to be repaid, the banks need to build greater and greater pools of debt. This is why, when you are late in paying your credit card, the interest rate jumps to 28%. This is why, if you declare bankruptcy, you are still responsible for paying off your student loan, even as 1 million people a year default on student loans, with 40% of all borrowers expected to default on student loans by 2023. This all comes from the New York Times, by the way.
You're listening to episode 13 of Other Voices, Other Choices, which is America, the Farewell Tour, a talk by Chris Hedges.
This is why wages are stagnant or have declined, while costs from healthcare and pharmaceutical products to bank fees and basic utilities are skyrocketing. This is why the federal government, further stripped of $1.5 trillion over the next decade by the Trump tax cuts, will soon pay more in interest on its debt than it spends on the military, Medicaid, or children's programs combined. Within a decade, more than $900 billion in interest payments will be due annually. Interest on debt is now the fastest growing major government expense. The cost of interest will hit $390 billion next year, and that's nearly a 50% increase from 2017, according to the Congressional Budget Office. The global financial system is a ticking time bomb. The question is not if it will explode, but when it will explode. And once it does, the inability of the global speculators to use fabricated money with zero interest to paper over the debacle will trigger massive unemployment, high prices for imports and basic services, and very probably a devaluation of the dollar when it is abandoned as the world's reserve currency. No one knows when this will happen, although the historian Alfred McCoy says the American empire, as we know it, will no longer exist by 2030. This manufactured financial tsunami will transform the United States, already a failed democracy, into an authoritarian police state, awash in weapons and driven by hate. Life will become very cheap, especially for the vulnerable, undocumented workers, Muslims, poor people of color, girls and women, anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist critics who will be branded as agents of a foreign power. All will be demonized and persecuted for the collapse. The ruling elites, in a desperate bid to cling to their unchecked power and obscene wealth, will sanction indiscriminate violence against any group or individual they fear could instigate a revolt. Empires in decay, ravaged by widespread enemy, embrace an almost willful suicide. Blinded by their hubris and unable to face the reality of their diminishing power, they retreat into a fantasy world where hard and unpleasant facts no longer intrude. They replace diplomacy, multilateralism, participatory politics with a constant mobilization against enemies, real or invented. This self-delusion of late empire saw the United States make the greatest strategic blunder in its history, one that sounded the death knell of the American empire, the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. The architects of the war in the George W. Bush White House and the array of useful idiots in the press and academia who were cheerleaders for it, knew very little about the countries being invaded, were stunningly naive about the effects of industrial warfare, and were blindsided by the ferocious blowback. They stated and probably believed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, although they had no valid evidence to support this claim. They insisted that democracy would be implanted in Baghdad and spread across the Middle East. They assured the public that U.S. troops would be greeted by grateful Iraqis and Afghans as liberators. They promised that the oil revenues would cover the cost of reconstruction. They insisted that the bold and quick military strike, shock and awe, would restore American hegemony in the region and dominance in the world. It did the opposite. Historians of empire call these military fiascos a feature of all late empires. Micromilitarism. The Athenians engaged in micromilitarism when, during the Peloponnesian War, they invaded Sicily, suffering the loss of 200 ships and thousands of soldiers and triggering revolts throughout the empire. Britain engaged in 1956 in micromilitarism when it attacked Egypt in a dispute over the nationalization of the Suez Canal, and then quickly withdrew in humiliation, empowering a string of Arab nationalist leaders such as Egypt's Gamal Abdel Nasser, and dooming British rule over the nation's few remaining colonies. Neither of these empires recovered. Empires, because they rely on the power to dominate and exploit other countries, are in fact very fragile. Once this ability to dominate is gone, they unravel swiftly. A year for Portugal, 2 years for the Soviet Union, 8 years for France, 11 years for the Ottoman Empire, 17 for Great Britain, and in all likelihood, 27 years for the United States, counting from the crucial year 2003 when we invaded Iraq. Empires are hollowed out from the inside. Their cities fall into decay. And I just come from the New York subway system. 22-minute wait in Penn Station for the next subway. The decline sees the brutality abroad matched by a growing brutality at home. Militarized police gunned down, mostly unarmed, poor people of color, and fill a system of penitentiaries and jails that hold a staggering 25% of the world's prisoners, although we are only 5% of the world's population. The population at home, like the subjugated population abroad, lives under wholesale surveillance. Public services, including public education, infrastructure, and public transportation, become decrepit and dysfunctional. This rulelessness, this enemy, is best seen in the strata of our judiciary. There is an aggressive criminalization of the poor, while the ruling elites have virtual immunity. Protected by high-priced lawyers and non-enforcement or rewriting of laws. Amid selective enforcement of laws in the ruleless society, the high rollers on Wall Street and in wealthy enclaves are not prosecuted, for example, for possessing and ingesting illegal drugs, but the poor are thrown into prison and must forfeit all their property for being caught with small amounts of the same drugs. I live in Princeton, New Jersey, and I am sure there are as many drugs and probably of better quality in Princeton than there are in Trenton. But police in Kevlar vests, armed with long-barreled weapons, are not kicking in Princeton doors at 2 a.m. to terrorize families for a nonviolent drug warrant. HSBC, the world's seventh largest bank by total assets, after admitting to laundering $800 million for Central and South American drug cartels, was slapped with symbolic fines and a deferred prosecution agreement, which is the legal equivalent of a get-out-of-jail-free card. The poor, meanwhile, are hounded, arrested, and fined for absurdly criminalized activities such as not mowing their lawns, loitering, selling loose cigarettes, although Eric Garner was not, at the time he was murdered, selling loose cigarettes, carrying open containers of alcohol, or, this is my favorite, and it's real, obstructing pedestrian traffic, which means standing on a sidewalk. These fines are used to fill state and county budget shortfalls resulting from corporations and the wealthy fixing the rules to avoid paying meaningful taxes, if they pay taxes at all. This virtual taxed boycott by the rich has broken yet another vital social bond, the idea that everyone contributes a significant portion of his or her income to make the society function. The elites who sacrifice nothing for society and are not held accountable for their criminal behavior live in what Matt Taibbi calls a stateless archipelago, or what a writer for The New Yorker called Richistan. They are legally empowered to pillage the nation, amass obscene wealth, and wield unchecked political and legal control. Brett Kavanaugh, aside from most probably being a sexual predator, is, as Ralph Nader has said, a corporation masquerading as a human being. The result has been the obliteration of primary social bonds that, however biased, in favor of the white majority, once held the nation together. The shattering of these bonds has left tens of millions of Americans adrift. Society, Durkheim wrote, is no longer sufficiently present for individuals. Those cast aside can participate in the society, as Durkheim noted, only through sadness. The self-destructive pathologies that plague the United States, opioid addiction, morbid obesity, gambling, suicide, sexual sadism, we are a pornified culture, hate groups, mass shootings, rise out of this enemy. And my new book, America, the Farewell Tour, is an examination of these pathologies and the enemy that fuels these self-destructive behaviors. Durkheim also noted that the poor have lower rates of suicide because, as he wrote, the poor know that the rules are rigged against them. James Baldwin made much the same point when he wrote that African-American men are less prone to a midlife crisis than white men because they are less susceptible to the myth of the American dream. Most African-Americans learn very early in life that there are two sets of rules, one for blacks and one for whites. But white Americans, because of white supremacy, are more susceptible to the myth and therefore more infuriated when the myth is exposed as a con. This, I suspect, is why nearly all mass shootings and members of right-wing hate groups, along with a majority of supporters of Donald Trump, are white men. Capitalism, Durkheim wrote, is antithetical to creating and sustaining the relationships that are vital to social bonds. Capitalism rewards those for whom relationships are transactional and temporary. Relationships under capitalism are mercenary. They are part of the scheme for personal self-advancement and require the oily manipulation of others. To advance in a capitalist system, it is necessary to build and then discard a series of ultimately hollow relationships. These empty relationships, and you can see them on display at any business gathering, contribute to the collective enemy and disintegration of social bonds. Capitalism may cater to a natural desire among many for self-enrichment. But you don't want this greed to dominate society. Capitalism rewards single-minded narcissists and often con artists, devoid of empathy and incapable of remorse. It rewards those focused exclusively on personal gain and self-aggrandizement. Once a capitalist class achieves complete control, as it has in the United States, it dismantles the structures that make social bonds possible, seeing in them an impediment to profit. The more concentrated wealth becomes, as with corporate capitalism, the more damage it inflicts on society, sending jobs to overseas sweatshops and leaving American workers underemployed or unemployed.
You're listening to episode 13 of Other Voices, Other Choices, which is America, the Farewell Tour, a talk by Chris Hedges.
Karl Marx saw alienation as a positive force, one that estranged workers from the means of production and moved them to question the structures of power, educate themselves about their exploitation and revolt. But for Durkheim, this alienation or enemy is debilitating. It is, he wrote, a collective asthenia that drains us of energy and will. It manifests itself in self-loathing. We may indeed understand what is happening around us, Durkheim argued, but we lack the ability to free ourselves from the despair, frustration, and rage that cripple our lives. Our actions require an object outside of themselves, Durkheim wrote. It is not because we need to sustain the illusion of some impossible immortality. It is because it is implicit in our moral being and cannot be lost, even partially, without that moral being losing its reason for existence. There is no need to demonstrate that in such a state of collapse, the slightest cause for depression can easily give rise to desperate acts. When life is not worth living, everything becomes a pretext for ridding ourselves of it. For individuals are too closely involved in the life of society for it to be sick without their being affected, Durkheim wrote. Its suffering inevitably becomes theirs. Trump is not the product of the leak of the Podesta emails, James Comey, or even racism, although he and many who support him are racists. Nor is he the product of Russian bots. Demagogues always arise from failed democracies, plagued by rulelessness, by enemy. They tell an enraged population what it wants to hear, and crudely, to the delight of the betrayed, ridicule the elites who sold them out. Removing Trump from office without confronting the enemy that defines the lives of tens of millions of Americans would do nothing to restore democracy. In fact, it would probably consolidate the power of a Christianized fascism, rapidly filling Trump's ideological void, which cloaks itself in a cloying piety and false morality. Vice President Mike Pence, because he is a creature of the Christian right, would probably, as Noam Chomsky has pointed out, would probably be worse than Trump if he gained the presidency. This enemy, as it always does, has empowered demagogues who must be understood as cult leaders rather than traditional politicians. A disempowered population, infantilized by a world it cannot control, gravitates to cult leaders who appear omnipotent and promise a return to a mythical golden age. The cult leaders vow to crush the forces embodied in demonized groups and individuals which are blamed for their misery. The more outrageous the cult leaders become, the more they flout law and social conventions, the more they gain in popularity. Cult leaders are immune to the norms of established society. This is their appeal. Cult leaders demand a godlike power. Those who follow them grant them this power in the hope that the cult leaders will save them. Trump has transformed the decayed carcass of the Republican Party into a cult. All cults are personality cults. They are extensions of the cult leaders. The cult reflects the leader's prejudices, worldview, personal style, and ideas. Trump did not create the yearning for a cult leader. Huge segments of the population betrayed by the established elites were conditioned for a cult leader. They were desperately looking for someone to rescue them and solve their problems. They found their cult leader in the New York real estate developer and reality television show star. Only when we recognize Trump as a cult leader, and many of those who support him as cult followers, will we understand where we are headed and how we must resist. It was 40 years ago, last month, that a messianic preacher named Jim Jones convinced or forced more than 900 of his followers, including roughly 280 children, to die by ingesting a cyanide-laced drink. Trump's refusal to acknowledge and address the impending crisis of ecocide and the massive mismanagement of the economy by the kleptocrats, his bellicosity, his threats against Iran and China, his withdrawal from nuclear arms treaties, along with his demonization of all who oppose him, ensure our cultural and, if left unchecked, physical extinction. Cult leaders are driven at their core by the death instinct, the instinct to annihilate or destroy rather than nurture and create. And Trump shares many of the characteristics of Jones, as well as other cult leaders, including the founders of the Heaven's Gate cult, Reverend Sun Myung Moon, who led the Unification Church, and David Koresh, who led the Branch Davidian cult in Waco, Texas. Cult leaders are narcissists. They demand obsequious fawning and total obedience. They prize loyalty above competence. They wield absolute control. They do not tolerate criticism. They are amoral and emotionally and physically abusive. They see those around them as objects to be manipulated for their own empowerment, enjoyment, and often sadistic entertainment. All those outside the cult are branded as forces of evil, prompting an epic battle whose natural expression is violence. A cult is a mirror of what is inside the cult leader, Margaret Singer wrote in Cults in Our Midst. He has no restraints on him. He can make his fantasies and desires come alive in the world he creates around him. He can lead people to do his bidding. He can make the surrounding world really his world. What most cult leaders achieve is akin to the fantasies of a child at play, creating a world with toys and utensils. In that play world, the child feels omnipotent and creates a realm of his or her own for a few minutes or a few hours. He moves the toy dolls about. They do his bidding. They speak his words back to him. He punishes them any way he wants. He is all powerful and makes his fantasy come alive. When I see the sand tables and the collections of toys some child therapists have in their offices, I think that a cult leader must look about and place people in his created world, much as a child creates on the sand table a world that reflects his or her desires and fantasies. The difference is that the cult leader has actual humans doing his bidding as he makes a world around him that springs from inside his own head. George Orwell understood that cult leaders manipulate followers primarily through language, not force. This linguistic manipulation is a gradual process. It is rooted in continual mental chaos and verbal confusion. Lies, conspiracy theories, outlandish ideas, and contradictory statements that defy reality and fact soon paralyze the opposition. The opposition, with every attempt to counter this absurdism with the rational, such as the decision by Barack Obama to make his birth certificate public, or by Senator Elizabeth Warren to release the results of her DNA test to prove she has Native American ancestry, only plays to the cult leader. The cult leader does not take his or her statements seriously and often denies ever making them, even when they are documented. Lies and truth do not matter. The language of the cult leader is designed exclusively to appeal to the emotional needs of those in the cult. Hitler kept his enemies in a state of constant confusion and diplomatic upheaval, Joost A.M. Merleau wrote in The Rape of the Mind, The Psychology of Thought Control, Menticide, and Brainwashing. They never knew what this unpredictable madman was going to do next. Hitler was never logical because he knew that that was what he was expected to be. Logic can be met with logic, while illogic cannot. It confuses those who think straight. The big lie and monotonously repeated nonsense have more emotional appeal in a Cold War than logic and reason. While the enemy is still searching for a reasonable counterargument to the first lie, the totalitarians can assault him with another. Cult leaders engage in the permanent lie. The permanent lie is different from the falsehood and half-truths uttered by politicians such as Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, or Barack Obama. The common political lie these politicians employed was not designed to cancel out reality. It was a form of manipulation. Clinton, when he signed into law the North American Free Trade Agreement, promised, and I'm quoting, NAFTA means jobs, American jobs, and good-paying American jobs. George W. Bush, justified the invasion of Iraq because Saddam Hussein supposedly possessed weapons of mass destruction. But Clinton does not continue to pretend that NAFTA is beneficial to the working class, since reality has proved otherwise. Bush does not pretend that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, once it was clear none were found. The permanent lie, however, is not circumscribed by reality. It is perpetuated even in the face of overwhelming evidence that discredits it. It is irrational. Those who speak in the language of truth and fact are attacked as liars, traitors, and purveyors of fake news. They are banished from the public sphere once totalitarian elites accrue sufficient power. The iron refusal by those who engage in the permanent lie to acknowledge reality, no matter how transparent reality becomes, creates collective psychosis. The result of a consistent and total substitution of lies for factual truth is not that the lie will now be accepted as truth and truth be defamed as a lie, but that the sense by which we take our bearings in the real world and the category of truth versus falsehood is among the mental means to this end is being destroyed, Hannah Arendt wrote in The Origins of Totalitarianism. The permanent lie is the apotheosis of totalitarianism. It no longer matters what is true. It matters only what is correct. And federal courts are being stacked with Federalist Society judges who served the correct ideology of corporatism and the rigid social mores of the Christian right. They hold reality, including science and the rule of law, in contempt. They seek to banish those who live in a reality-based world defined by intellectual and moral autonomy. Consistency is discarded. Complexity, nuance, depth, and profundity are replaced with the simpleton's belief in threats and force. And this is why the Trump administration disdains diplomacy and has dynamited the State Department. Totalitarianism, wrote the novelist and social critic Thomas Mann, is at its core the desire for a simple folktale. Once this folktale replaces reality, morality and ethics are abolished. And as Voltaire reminded us, those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. The cult leader grooms followers to speak in the language of hate and violence. The cult leader constantly paints a picture of an existential threat, often invented, such as the caravan, that puts cult followers in danger. The 4,000 immigrants, most from Honduras, in southern Mexico, are in fact nothing new. Caravans of immigrants have been with us for several years. The beleaguered and impoverished asylum seekers, including many families with children, have made that journey from Honduras up through Mexico many times before. But Trump, aided by nearly nonstop coverage by Fox News and Christian broadcasting, used the caravan during the elections to terrify his followers. Just as he, along with the same media outlets, portrayed the protesters who flooded the U.S. Capitol to oppose the nomination of Kavanaugh, were portrayed as unruly mobs.
You're listening to episode 13 of Other Voices, Other Choices, which is America, the Farewell Tour, a talk by Chris Hedges.
Trump claims the Democrats want to open the border to these quote-unquote criminals and to, quote, unknown Middle Eastern terrorists. Christian broadcasting, such as Pat Robertson's 700 Club, was splicing pictures of marching jihadists in black uniforms cradling automatic weapons into video shots of the caravan of migrants. The fear-mongering and rhetoric of hate and violence, as I saw in the former Yugoslavia, eventually leads to acts of violence against those the cult leader defines as the enemy. The 13 explosive devices sent to Trump critics and leaders of the Democratic Party, including Obama, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, George Soros, James Clapper, and CNN, allegedly by Cesar Sayoc, an ex-stripper and fanatic Trump supporter who was living out of his van, heralds more violence. And Trump, tossing gasoline on the flames, used that assault against most of the leadership of the Democratic Party to attack the press, or as he calls it, the enemy of the people. And it should come as no surprise that another enraged American white male, his fury and despair, seemingly stoked by the diatribes and conspiracy theories of the far right, entered a Pittsburgh synagogue and massacred 8 men and 3 women as he shouted anti-Semitic abuse. The proliferation of easily accessible, high-caliber weapons, coupled with the division of the country into the blessed and the damned by Trump and his fellow cultists, threatens to turn the landscape into one that resembles Mexico, where at least 145 people in politics, including 48 candidates and pre-candidates, along with party leaders and campaign workers, have been assassinated over the last 12 months. Look south if you want a vision of the future. The cult leader, unlike a traditional politician, makes no effort to reach out to his opponents. The cult leader seeks to widen the divisions. The cult leader brands those outside the cult as irredeemable. The cult leader seeks the omnipotence to crush those who do not kneel in adoration. The followers yearning to be protected and empowered by the cult leader seek to give the cult leader unlimited power. Democratic norms and impediment to the leader's omnipotence are ridiculed, attacked, and abolished. Those in the cult seek to be surrounded by the cult leader's magical aura. Reality is sacrificed for fantasy. Those who challenge the fantasies are not considered human. They are satanic. Behavior that ensures the destruction of a public figure's career does not affect a cult leader. It does not matter how many lies uttered by Trump are meticulously documented by the New York Times or the Washington Post. It does not matter that Trump's personal financial interests, as we see in his relationship with the Saudis, takes precedent over the rule of law, diplomatic protocols, and national security. It does not matter that he is credibly charged by numerous women with being a sexual predator, a common characteristic of cult leaders. It does not matter that he paid little or no income taxes and routinely committed financial fraud. It does not matter that he is inept, lazy, and ignorant. The establishment whose credibility has been destroyed because of its complicity in empowering the ruling oligarchy and the corporate state might as well be blowing soap bubbles at Trump. Their vitriol to his followers only justifies the hatred radiating from the cult. The removal of Trump from power would not remove the yearning of tens of millions of Americans, many conditioned by the Christian right, for a cult leader. Most of the leaders of the Christian right have built cult followings of their own. These Christian fascists embraced magical thinking, attacked their enemies as agents of Satan, and denounced reality-based science and journalism long before Trump. Cults are a product of social decay, of anomy, and our decay and despair are expanding, soon to explode in another financial crisis. The efforts by the Democratic Party and much of the press, including CNN and the New York Times, to discredit Trump as if our problems are embodied in him alone are futile. The smug self-righteousness of this crusade against Trump only contributes to the national reality television show that has replaced journalism and politics. This crusade attempts to reduce a social, economic, and political crisis to the personality of Trump. It is accompanied by a refusal to confront and name the corporate forces responsible for our failed democracy and growing social inequality. This collusion with the forces of corporate domination neuters the press and Trump's mainstream Democratic critics. Our only hope is to organize the overthrow of the corporate state that vomited up Trump. Our democratic institutions, including the legislative bodies, the courts, and the media, are hostage to corporate power. They are no longer democratic. We must, like liberation movements of the past, engage in sustained mass civil disobedience and non-cooperation as we are seeing today on the streets of Paris. By turning our ire on the corporate state, we name the true sources of power and abuse. We expose the absurdity of blaming our demise on demonized groups such as undocumented workers, Muslims, African Americans, Latinos, liberals, feminists, gays, and others. We give people an alternative to a Democratic Party that refuses to confront the corporate forces of oppression and cannot be rehabilitated. We make possible the restoration of an open society. If we fail to embrace this militancy, which alone has the ability to destroy cult leaders, we will continue the march toward tyranny. Thank you.
You're listening to episode 13 of Other Voices, Other Choices, which is America, the Farewell Tour, a talk by Chris Hedges. We end his talk with two excerpts from the Q&A.
When you can, day after day, as was true in East Germany or was true in Prague, get 500,000 people shutting down the center of the city. And of course, nonviolence is key. And what has hurt the Paris protests has been both from the far left and the far right, the anarchists and the far right who have carried out property destruction and burnt cars. This is a gift to the state. That didn't happen in East Germany and Czechoslovakia. Romania was a little different, where I also was. So it's essentially the South African understanding of non-cooperation. It is creating disciplined, peaceful, massive, sustained protests. And the danger of that, as all of the theorists, and what I'm talking about is revolution, but the danger of that, as all of the theorists of revolution have noted, for Crane Brinton, Jeffrey Davies, and others, all of whom say that no revolution succeeds until a significant portion of the ruling apparatus defects, or at least is neutralized, is not willing to defend the regime. And this took place in East Germany in September of 1989 when Erich Honecker, the dictator, sent down an elite paratroop division to Leipzig with orders to fire on the demonstrators. When the paratroopers got there, the city authorities refused to deploy them in the streets. Honecker was out of power within a week. The same was true in Czechoslovakia. Once it was clear that the security forces would not defend the discredited communist elites, they were done for. And so that's why nonviolence is key. And you just go back through the history of every revolution, and they have succeeded because of these defections, which creates paralysis within the mechanisms of ruling power. So I write about Standing Rock. That's a very good example, 7 months of nonviolent resistance led by a deeply spiritual, and I think that spiritual element is important, by Native American leaders and all there. You know, there were 10,000 people when I was there, about half of them were white people, but the Native American elders were quite astute about making them sit through long lectures about what they were doing and why and the tactics they would use. So it's rebuilding those mass movements, which really is our only hope. You've seen flashes of it. You saw it with the teachers' strikes in places like West Virginia. Never forget that they defied their union leadership, who wanted to accept the contract. You saw it a few years ago with the teachers' strike in Chicago. But really, that's it, because that's the only way that we're going to succeed is to pit power against power, and the only power we have is that we're a lot more than they are. Economic justice versus social justice, King wouldn't have made that distinction. King was quite clear that there would not be an end to racism until there was economic justice. And of course, when King crossed over, especially after he denounced the Vietnam War, that white liberal base fled from him as if he had leprosy, because they were willing to accept desegregation in the South, but they weren't willing to take the next step, which was, in essence, to give to African Americans the reparations they are long overdue. And affirmative action, as Johnson said in his speech at Howard University when he announced it, was designed as reparations. It's been distorted and disfigured to be about diversity. It was never about diversity. It was about accepting the fact that white Americans owe African Americans a lot. They built the damn country, first of all. In the same way that Germany accepted its responsibility for what it had done to the Jews in World War II. We've never done it historically. So I don't make that distinction. I think the fact that the boutique activism of the left has focused on multiculturalism and identity politics to the exclusion of economic justice is why people of color often have such disdain for the white liberal class. And I saw that in Zuccotti Park. So Zuccotti Park was, which I supported. I mean, I love those kids. But it was largely a middle-class, college-educated, driven white. And for the first time, that's what Bakunin called déclassé intellectuals, people who expected to find a place within the elite systems and then found there was no place for them. And this is kind of arcane, but Marx and Bakunin went back and forth. Marx saying hated déclassé intellectuals, Bakunin arguing, I think correctly, that they are vital to fusing any successful revolutionary movement. But you didn't find poor people of color from East New York or there, because what those white kids were experiencing, which was underemployment, unemployment, lack of benefits, evictions, are something that had been going on going back several decades into poor communities under neoliberalism in particular. And we got diverted, I'm talking about white people, and got caught up. We forgot the primacy of economic justice. So I think that division has hurt us. And it's something that the great radicals like King understood.
You've been listening to episode 13 of Other Voices, Other Choices. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of the series. This episode is America, the Farewell Tour, a talk by Chris Hedges. He spoke at the Unitarian Church of All Souls in New York City on December 9th, 2018. The audio is sourced from a YouTube video of the same name, which was filmed by Joe Friendly and can be found on his YouTube channel. You can find Other Voices, Other Choices on iTunes and YouTube. Thanks for listening.